Welcome, everyone. This is Paul Niefer, the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer Magazine. And today I'm joined by Kristen Hebert from Saskatchewan, Canada. This is our first international farmer. I guess we can call Canada international. It's part of North America. How are things going for you, Kristen?
Well, it's pretty good up here, Paul. Kind of a bit of a warm front, as I hear quite a few of the, especially the northern states are. So we'd take a little bit of moisture to convince us all to not go planting here 2 weeks before we should.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the same down in our area. Some of our farmers certainly we're doing spring planting right now. This would be our normal spring planting time. But there's also parts of our country here within a few miles of us that haven't had rain for over a month. So it would be nice to get some rain here. So I think what we'll do to start off is just give me a background on your current farm operation, maybe the history, where exactly you're located, just for our listeners out there and so on.
Yeah, so we're located at Mooseman, Saskatchewan. So for the American listeners, that's 120 miles directly north of Minot, North Dakota. We're just an hour from the Canada-US border. So farm's pretty similar to what you'd see in North Dakota. Currently, we're going to crop right around 28,000 acres. We grow canola, malt barley, yellow peas, a little bit of hybrid rye, hard red spring wheat, and oats occasionally. And yeah, we're family farm. So it's the ownership group is my parents, Louie and Karen, and my wife, Teresa, and I. And our operations manager, farm manager, is also a minority partner. Okay. We got a pretty good team, and it's grown. I guess to go back, I think Louis's first crop was in 78. I moved home from university in 04, and we were about 4,500 acres then.
So you've grown just a tiny bit over the last 16 or 17 years. So I'm just curious, we were talking about this just briefly offline. My perception of farms in Canada is that the typical farm up there is larger than, let's say, a typical farm in the United States. Can you just give us sort of a observation on whether that's accurate or what your perception of farms between Canada and U.S. might look like?
Yeah, I think in acre base, you're probably correct. I would say probably, a smaller farm in especially Western Canada would be 1,500 to 2,500 acres now. Kind of what you'd call average is probably that 4,500 to 6,000 acres. And there's a couple of them that are obviously very large, 90 to 100,000 plus acres. Not too many are up to that size, but I'd kind of say that 4,500 to 6,500 acres is pretty normal. I guess when we look at farms in both Canada and the U.S., Paul, one thing that kind of differentiates is the revenue, right? In Canada, in most areas in Western Canada, farms are trying to hit a 500, or slightly plus revenue per acre. Mm-hmm. Just because our canola might run, call it 45, 50 bushels an acre, and you sell it for normally 10 to 12 bucks. Right now, it's a little better than that. But sometimes that's a little easier way to look at farms is more from a revenue per acre standpoint, because obviously if a guy growing 250 bushel corn at $4 or $5 is trying to hit $1,200 an acre revenue, it's kind of 2.5 acres to one.
Yeah. And even out in my area last year, we had some pretty good wheat yields. I'm on the edge of the Palouse country in southeastern Washington state, and we had several farmers hit that 160 to 170 bushel per acre on wheat yields. And this is dry land, soft white wheat yields. And, when you're right now, you can sell that for about $6 a bushel. So, if you multiply six times 150, that's $900 to $1,000 per acre. So I can see what you mean. Now, curious, I don't think you have any of this. In our area, we grow winter wheat. Is there any, we also grow some spring wheat, but is there any crops up there that you plant in the fall, or is everything that you do spring planting?
Yeah, no, there's a fair bit of winter wheat in the area. We haven't grown it very often. We actually grow a fall hybrid rye, and it's, we usually probably do it 2 years out of every three, just depending on where the market's at and how harvest goes.
Okay. I was just curious on that. So, Now, again, you've mentioned that you've grown from, let's say, roughly 4,500 acres up to about 27,000, 28,000. That is a pretty good growth over a 17-year period. I guess I'm just curious. I always try to ask this of all the people that I interview. What do you think you did right? What did you think you did wrong? And then maybe would you do any of it over?
I think if I was to start with what I did wrong, would be kind of early on, I'd try to find work or try to find expansion. And then once that was found, then go find people. And I think that's a pretty good way to create insanity. So we've switched that philosophy pretty significantly in the last, let's call it 8 to 10 years, where, you know, we find good people, or if good people come to us, we just make room for them and then we go find expansion. And that's really kind of made life a lot simpler, and that I probably have slightly higher labor dollars per acre than pretty much any farm I ever look at. But it also means that, for instance, this last winter we had a 7,000 acre expansion come at us, and we, you know, had a little team vote and everyone votes yes. Nobody sees it as a big deal at all. So that's probably the number one thing that I did wrong at the start, and then eventually corrected. Part of that was my farm manager is really, really good with people in HR. So when he came on board, it helped perfect that theory quite a bit. When it comes to what we did right, you know, we've always been pretty good at math. So I'd say that we're calculated risk takers. So even though it seems sometimes that we might expand pretty hard or pretty fast, you know, we have a pretty good understanding of how the programs work and a really good relationship with our lender. And you know, I've shown you before, Paul, I mean, we have monthly dashboards and kind of all our critical formulas. So we have a pretty good idea, you know, how the future is going to play out, whether it's a bad year or a good year, for at least 3 years at a time. So that part, that calculated risk is, you know, it takes stress off when you know that number. And then would I do it all again? I mean, I'm kind of like every other farmer. I mean, I got two packages of land I rented when I was younger that went up for sale, and I thought it was too much money 10 or 15 years ago, and I have to drive by it every day as I drive to the main farm. So if I was to do it again, I wouldn't have missed those.
Yeah. I think all farmers would echo that comment. There's always that one piece of ground that you go, oh man, I'm upset that I missed getting that piece of ground. So now again, Christian, I am a CPA, and I know, I think in Canada, is it called a chartered accountant up there, or is it still a CPA?
Yeah, it's still CPA. Why,
okay, so just go over, why did you start off that way, and then what led you to come back to the farm?
Yeah, I mean, when I finished high school, I had reasonable marks, and I didn't know what I wanted to be, and kind of direction from career counselors was you should be a doctor. So I took my first year of pre-med and did all my sciences and physics and calculus, and came home that year and said to my family, you know, I don't think I really like this. I might just go take agriculture and come home to farm. And my dad pulled me aside and said, you know, I can teach you how to farm pretty well, actually, but the business side of farming is what's really speeding up on me. And I think you should look at business. So in my second year, I took some business courses and really enjoyed it, and ended up taking a business degree, majoring in accounting and finance. And when we moved home, my wife and I, you know, we were 2,500, 2,000 acres. So that's not quite enough for two families. So I articled at Myers Norse Penny, a big agriculture firm in Canada, did, you know, every hour I could in the world of agriculture, other than the few I had to put in for my audit guidelines to get my letters. And when I got my letters in 04, in 07, 08, then I stayed around for another couple winters with the accounting firm. But by that time, you know, I realized how much I did love farming and agriculture. And it's kind of maybe a little unique for me. The accounting firm probably made me love agriculture more than I knew I did when I grew up, because my favorite part's the business side. I am the guy that doesn't run a lot of equipment. I still run a drill all the time, but I mean, I don't haul much grain. I love the business side. So that, you know, being a CPA kind of taught me a lot about agriculture that maybe people don't assume about the industry and about the business. And that's kind of what taught me how much I loved it and wanted to do it full time.
Yeah, it was when you were discussing, you started pre-med and then you switched over to business because you found out that you really didn't like pre-med as much as you thought you would. I remember when I was in college, I went to the University of Washington, and I was either going to be a finance major or an accounting major. I liked both. And I was, at one point, I was sort of leaning toward finance, but I happen to remember going into where you sign up for your major, you know, after your sophomore year. And there's a little plaque up on the wall, and it said that if you wanted to go into the accounting department, you had to have a GPA of at least 3.6. And I was thinking to myself, well, that must be a little bit more prestige going into accounting than finance. And that was the reason why I became an accounting major. I mean, it wasn't, you know, this great thought or anything. It was just this little thing triggered it. And then that, it's funny how little things during your lifetime will zig you one way versus the other. So it's just interesting. Okay. So, and I know, and I'm not going to use the right term here, Christian. I already know that because I forgot what the term was, but I'm going to call it standard operating procedures. I know that your farm has standardized a lot of the procedures. Go over what that term is that you use and describe that process.
Yeah, we kind of like to call them playbooks, but just because we call our team, we talk about it as a hockey team all the time versus a corporate structure. And we've standardized quite a bit, but I mean, some of the easy ones, I always like to bring up some easy ones for people that are just going to start. I mean, something as easy as we use Voxer for all our team communication. It works between iPhones, Androids, computers, et cetera. And you can have your spray team and your cedar team and your office team so that every time something needs to be communicated, everybody on that team is updated and you don't have to send, you know, 6 or 7 separate text messages or emails, et cetera. So something like Voxer is pretty simple. We use Trello for project management, just on flowing things through the shop or you know, to-do items that come out of meetings. So it's a pretty easy one to implement. And then, yeah, we're definitely not done them, but we've started our way down the path and kind of pick a couple every month to keep adding to it. But, you know, we got a playbook on something as simple as, you know, how does a day run in the sprayer? And that means that, you know, the wheel should be rolling by 5 o'clock, and here's what the wind can be. Here's what the leaf wetness can be. If the wind gets to 20 kilometers an hour, here's what our spray nozzle pressure goes to. If the wind gets to 25, that's when we shut down. But when we shut down, this is how we leave the sprayers. This is how we leave the mix truck. And this is the handoff we make to the next shift. So it's just, they're pretty simple. And try and break big processes down into smaller ones that you can just have kind of a 1 or 2 page, you know, playbook on it that, it, you know, at least a new person could review it and feel like they have to ask less questions or say something as simple as loading the grain truck, the Super B we call it. You know, they can probably take that playbook and do it correctly the first time without any help. And then the more significant stuff, they still probably need some help and some training, but at least they don't feel uncomfortable when they go to do it the first time.
And I think that's important. You know, there are so many tasks now in farming that, you know, with technology, A, it's made your life easier, but B, it also can make your life more complicated if you don't understand how the technology works. And then sort of break it down. You know, I'm a firm believer of the KISS proposal or the KISS method. You know, keep it simple, stupid. And sometimes I think we try to make it more complicated than it really needs to be. So I think that's a good idea. Now, you had mentioned your monthly dashboard. Go over that process a little bit. I know when, because I had you speak at our AICPA Ag Conference here late last year, and you went over those dashboards on screen for us. Now you know, this is an audio podcast, so we can't really go through that, but explain how it works, what you typically have on that dashboard. And I think there was something, you know, as far as maybe long-term trend, it was sort of bringing up the fact that if you continue down this road, you might go broke in a couple of years or something like that. So go over that, the information.
Yeah. So, I mean, our monthly dashboard is the pure financial one. We kind of track. I kind of say, I don't even need to look at financials anymore. I just look at this 2-pager that comes from my CFO and it lets me know everything I need. So on there, there's, you know, debt service, working capital percent. We like to call it debt by silo. So our operating debt versus our machinery debt versus our land debt. And then, you know, expected margin by crop and where we're targeting towards that. Same with, you know, where we are on forward sales, et cetera. Expenses to budget so that we can have discussions on, you know, each critical element there. And then we also talk a lot about people's hours to budget on that monthly scorecard. The story I was telling then is if we wanted to continue to expand it at this type of a speed with current equipment prices, we were on a pretty fast pay down speed on the debt side of it in 3 and 4 year terms. And all we needed to do was extend those terms to, you know, 5 or 7 years on the debt side of the equipment with low interest rates. And the fact of the matter is equipment is not worth nothing after 3 to 5 years. Most of it has a significantly longer than 10 year life. The debt speed was just, it was eating away at cash flow, even though returns were surely strong. So just being able to see that every month and the trend allow us to put in a plan with our lender now instead of 3 or 4 years from now when cash could have been at a critical position if we'd had a couple bad years in a row. So being able to see that and have that foresight, I mean, it makes working with your partners a lot easier. And it also, you know, kind of lets you sleep at night. If you know the worst case scenario, even if it's 3 years away already, you have lots of time to plan for it. So that's what the monthly dashboard is for. We have a weekly dashboard that is more kind of our execution side. So that's where we track actually each individual person's hours compared to last year, you know, overtime hours. We know that days over 16 hours are what cause, you know, HR issues. And obviously on farms, you have the odd one of those. So we track that, you know, the tons of grain sold versus produced and where we are at on hauling pace throughout the winter. And then in seeding and harvest, we actually tighten it right up into a 48-hour dashboard of where our team's hours are and where we are from a optimization and efficiency standpoint on the equipment every 48 hours to make sure we're on track with the plan.
I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, that you might have somebody that's working 12, 14, 16 hours in a day. And, you know, all of us that grew up on a farm, you know, during harvest, I know with my dad, when I was operating the combine or driving truck for him, you know, we're up at 5 a.m. We head out to the field. Now we can't quite get out harvesting right away, but we're greasing the combine and getting service done. And then, you know, we get done at 9 o'clock at night. So, you know, that's a long day, but you know, it's only a 3, 4, 5, 6 week type period. In the United States, most areas were not required to pay any extra overtime, you know, no time and a half, no double time. Although there's 3 or 4 states that's changing, including my state, we're going to have overtime here starting fairly quickly. What's the process in Canada? If somebody works more than, let's say, 40 hours in a week, do they get time and a half or is it just straight time or how does that work up in Canada?
Yeah, there's no federal or provincial laws that you're required to pay overtime. We actually, on our farm, we do time and a quarter for anything over 40 hours for our crew. As I said, it's not required anywhere in Canada. Some farms probably get mad that I do it, to tell you the truth, but it's just it's kind of an appreciation factor for both the team member and their spouse that work on those overtime hours in those critical times for us, you know, obviously allow us to hit our targets, but also, you know, hopefully pay for their warm vacation, et cetera, post COVID. And then, yeah, we've really switched to shifts. So, I mean, even my air seeders are on 12 hour shifts with kind of a 2 hour overlap. So guys show up early by about an hour. And if we need them at the end, they stay for an extra hour, but we do everything we can to make sure that shifts stay in that 12 to 14 hour range in seeding and harvest and don't get to 16 or above. We've really noticed that's when people really get drugged down. Yeah. 12-hour shifts they can handle for quite some time. You know, that still gets you home to see your wife and kids and get a good sleep. But the 16-hour ones are just not safe.
Yeah. And the same, you know, us CPAs, you know, typically, although I've gotten older, I'm probably slowing down a little bit. But, you know, I'm still putting in a 12 to 14-hour day from, you know, the first part of February through April 15th. This year, maybe May 17th because of our delay and so on. And we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment with more of the Farm CPA podcast.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA. at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back to the Farm CPA podcast. We're going to continue our conversation with Christian Hebert. You had mentioned your banker. You know, in the U.S., we sort of have commercial banks like a Wells Fargo is one of the larger commercial farm lenders that they were. I think they're starting to wind down a little bit. You have a lot of community banks. I mean, in the United States, you know, state of Iowa might have 100 or 200 community banks. And then there's the Farm Credit Bank system. So those all can provide loans to farmers. But I think Canada is a little bit more unique. Don't you only have maybe 8 or 10 national banks, or are there local banks? Just go through that process as far as borrowing money in Canada versus the U.S.
Yeah, no, there is only about 6 or 7 national banks. And I would say only 2 or 3 of them really do anything in agriculture. And then we have a kind of a farm credit, which is a quasi government backed lender, doesn't do operating capital, but does capital for land and equipment. And then kind of some of the special ones for agriculture, the credit unions, they're kind of like co-ops, and they're usually provincial based or kind of multi-provincial based. And they do a lot of heavy focus on what I'd call small business and agriculture and fill a pretty big void for lending to agriculture in Canada as well.
Is there any cross-border lending? Would you come to the U.S. to borrow money from a bank that's based in the U.S., or is it primarily just Canadian-based?
Well, it's primarily Canadian-based. I think 3 of our national banks have cross-border locations, though, even some pretty significant ones. So it's not too hard for us to deal down in the U.S. if we're buying something, or I think if we wanted to come actually start operating down there, then we'd look for a second partner in the U.S. just for operating capital to make it a lot simpler. But when it comes to assets, it's not too tough.
Okay. And then I know that you have some ventures outside of the farm, let's say. Can you go through sort of what those ventures are, maybe your history of how you got them started or why you got them started, and then your management structure, and then maybe what your future plans for those ventures might be?
Yeah, so I guess my main one is called Maverick Agriculture, Maverick Ag. It's a CFO/risk management consulting firm, does speaking services. And all that was is kind of the financial consulting and speaking was getting to be a pretty significant portion of my time, and the farm was growing too. So I needed to hire somebody to run it. And the easiest way was, you know, a long-term friend who we got to know each other really well in college in our accounting degree that had a lot of background in agriculture, was working at an accounting firm. So we kind of partnered up to launch Maverick Ag. His name's Evan Schout. He does the CFO work for my farm and another, you know, a few other large farms, and then does a lot of risk management consulting and setting up, you know, lending plans and risk plans for numerous clients, as well as some of the speaking that we were getting asked to do on our operation. You know, can I tell you exactly where Maverick's going? No, because we seem to get new opportunities thrown at us every couple of weeks. But, you know, it kind of followed our philosophy of collaboration and working together, you know, a rising tide kind of mentality. And it has. I mean, it's made our farm significantly better. The amount we learn from others and can share with others that are part of that consulting group is a significant win. And just the amount of opportunities that are getting thrown at Maverick on a kind of a twice a month speed right now lets me know that it was an area of the industry that was a real shortage and has a lot of opportunity. We just haven't quite decided, you know, what we want to be when we grow up there yet. The other one would be Global Ag Risk. It's a private insurance company I'm a shareholder in and chairman of the board. So it's a private crop insurance company based more on margin or business interruption insurance in the world of, you know, what CPAs would talk. It launched back in 2011 and is kind of one of 2 private insurance companies in Canada. Everything else is government based. And it, it grows every year. I don't have near as much to do with it as I used to. I kind of am slowing down to more of a board role on it, but who knows where it'll go to. I'm a firm believer that government should use more of their agriculture budget for, you know, for exports and fixing ports and making sure the river system and the rail system is all significant, and not waste near as much of it on public insurance programs that they do. I think a lot of them garner poor behavior, to tell you the truth. So I think it's an area where the private insurance industry can actually do a better job. And if there was enough competition, can be priced pretty competitively, and that the government budget could be spent on, you know, things to significantly affect our industry for my kids, which is really where I think government should be. But I won't go on too much of a government tangent.
And, speaking of risk management, you touched on that, briefly there. In the U.S., like you say, most of our crop insurance is really revenue based. I mean, it could be yield based, but it's still revenue based. Your crop insurance up there, is it still revenue based, or is it more, like you say, this margin base, or is it revenue plus this margin? Maybe go through some of the differences between Canadian risk management versus U.S. risk management.
Yeah, so I think our main government program is a yield-based program, crop by crop. We call it crop insurance. There's a government margin-based program that's more of a disaster type setup, and then our private program is a margin-based program. So it's, you know, the calculation is yield times price minus your three main inputs: seed, fertilizer, and chemical, leaves you with gross margin, and that's the number that gets insured. So that's how our product is based. And then there's another private product based on kind of a basket type effect on yield. So there's, you know, between all the programs, there's very few times that I don't think that a farmer can get pretty good coverage for a reasonable investment. I do agree with you down in the US, right? It's mainly either yield based or revenue based. I kind of find the unique difference, to be honest, is in Canada, the government programs are rolled out by government entities. And you have to go in and do it, where in the U.S. the government subs all that out to obviously the AIPs, of which then have a bunch of consultative agents. To be honest, I think the commission structure in the U.S. really skews the opinions of proper risk management plans going out to farmers. And that's probably one area that I think could be significantly fixed, where in Canada there is no commission structure on the government products. And so it really does, we find it lots of times is a mixture of private and public products, and it is more of a mentality of what is best for the farmer. And in my time in the U.S., because we were down there for a while, I wouldn't say that I could always say when I left a meeting that that's how I felt the farmer was getting treated.
Yeah, it was interesting. I had a discussion with an attorney a couple months ago, maybe a month ago, dealing with a farmer that was sort of sold a whole farm policy when it came out back in 2014. And it appeared, now again, this is based on the discussion I had, but it appeared that based on the structure of the farm operation and so on, a whole farm policy down the road might have made sense, but at the time it really didn't make sense. So I think there is some of that at times, not all the time, but there certainly can be some of that. When I talk to some farmers, actually I had a discussion with a farmer where they're actually downsizing for various reasons as part of the transition to the next generation. It made sense for them to downsize versus expand. Are you still think you're in the expansion mode, or is there a point where you say, hey, I think we're at the size where we want to be, we'll focus on this size and maybe do some other stuff outside of farming, or have you even reached that point yet?
Yeah, I mean, we never really chase expansion opportunities. When they come, seem to come to us for a discussion, and which makes it easier. I think when you're chasing, it's a little tougher. And so we just assess each opportunity as it does come. And I mean, don't get me wrong, it's out there that we're expanding and we're willing to expand, and we'll rent land, we'll buy land, we'll help you through a succession engagement, we'll maybe even do some tax planning. So it is slightly different, but we just assess each one as it comes. And if the calculated risks feels right and our team is excited for it, we'll take it on. But we also, you know, we also say fairly often that we want to farm our newest acre every bit as good as our first acre. And when we can't do that, then we're going to be done doing what we're doing. But I just find as we add really good people, there's a lot of parts of our operation that we're significantly better at 27,000 acres than we were at 5,000. So it's more a function of, can we continue to add really good people that do, you know, every bit as good of a job as us, if not better, and to look at each opportunity as an individual basis. I mean, I've talked to you, Paul, before. I'm a pretty big fan of multiples of 8,000. So if I'm not in a multiple of 8, there's a good chance I'm trying to get to a multiple of 8. But if I'm at a multiple of 8, then I'm going to have a harder look at something before I take it on.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm curious, you know, in my area in the wheat country, we're primarily crop share. I know if you go back to the Midwest or irrigated ground, it's almost always cash rent. In your area, is it a combination of both, or is there one that really dominates versus the other? I'm just curious on how it might look up in your area.
Yeah, I would say cash rent is probably 80 to 90%. You'll still find some crop shares. We do some margin-based kind of rental agreements, but the majority of it is cash rent.
Okay. I was just curious on that. So, and then I think we're getting close to the end of the discussion here. I guess one thing I always try to ask is there something that keeps you up at night?
Well, you want to know what? I sleep pretty good for kind of the reason that we try to take calculated risk. But there is, you know, the two things that I always say I want to have a plan to hedge before the next generation takes it on is policy and currency. You know, we can build plans that come to deal with Mother Nature issues and people issues we can deal with, but policy and currency issues can really throw a curveball at us. And so those are two that I spend a lot of time. If I get some time to just think, those are two areas that I focus on quite a bit to try and have some sort of a hedge or a better mitigation plan than we currently do.
Speaking of currency risk, is that something where you are actually hedging it using a futures contract, or how are you trying to mitigate your currency risk?
So for sure, we hedge some of it with the futures market. I guess our big issue is that, you know, it affects so many facets of our business and slightly different. So, you know, as our Canadian dollar is higher, our equipment cost will go down in Canada, but our grain, you know, our grain sales are also down because we're selling it all in US dollars and it converts less. So it's just, there's, when it comes to the equipment side, like the fixed cost side, as well as the revenue side, it's a bit of a teeter totter to try and have a good idea when the commodities are going to change based on a currency change, because they tend to be delayed reactions and you never know if it's delayed by 15 days or by 6 months. So the hedge on it, to be honest with you, Paul, my hedge should probably be to have an equal sized operation in the Dakotas and then I'd have it hedged. But that's not something I want to do yet.
Yeah. Well, I know futures contracts on currencies, you know, that's sort of a global market, so to speak. But, you know, in the U.S., we have a fairly robust futures exchange on corn, soybeans, you know, hard red, soft red wheat. I know there, I still think it's there, but the Winnipeg Exchange used to have, you know, ag contracts. As far as hedging canola or some of your crops, are you able to hedge those on a futures exchange? I'm just curious how that might work.
Yeah, so we hedge canola pretty significantly, and we'll use both canola and beans because beans is a pretty good correlated hedge. And then every other crop, I have to do some sort of a hedge off the American exchanges. So we, you know, we'll use wheat. Our wheat really is no different, sold off the same futures market as yours. Same with oats, but our special crops, you know, like peas, etc., there is no real way to hedge them. But canola, yeah, obviously being one of our main ones, it's as liquid as hedging, you know, soybeans or corn or wheat, the only thing we find is that I can't hedge it out as many years. You guys are liquid out farther ahead, but for the current year crop and next year's crop, the futures market works pretty reasonable.
Okay. Yeah. You were mentioning yellow peas. You grow yellow peas. I mean, that's what I grew up, on our farm. We raised wheat and yellow peas and the combine, we had to switch over to a pea bar. Now you don't use a pea bar. And then we had to, you know, change the cylinder from going 900 RPMs. We had to drop it down to 200 RPMs. And instead of flipping a switch like you might do on a combine now to drop the rotor speed, back then it was almost a 4-hour process because you had to pull off a pulley that weighed about 150 pounds and put it on, you know. So now I'm starting to sound like the old fart. Sorry about that.
Yeah. the more ideal in both Canada and the US, Paul, is that farming's farming. Sure, we raise different crops and we might use slightly different equipment with a planter and an air seeder, but there's two things that really affect every farm, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and that's people and cash flow. And there's two things that long-term, I think, can hurt them or help them more than we ever know, and that's policy and currency. And so those are, as long as you kind of focus on those things, I think every farm around the world can help each other be better at what they do. And it's almost one thing I really encourage, right, is we'd do a lot better if we'd all share a little more. Our fierce independence allows us to get through, you know, tough weather events, et cetera. But it also makes us pretty stubborn when it comes to collaborating and kind of that win-win idea of I'd like to share my good ones with you, but can I get your good ones back?
Yeah.
We'd move a lot faster. And I think we'd bang our heads against the wall a lot less too, because pretty much every farm's been through fairly similar consequences.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So I think we're definitely what I would say at the end of the conversation. But the one thing I always want to leave with, the last question that I like to ask when I'm having this conversation with farmers, whether they're in the U.S. or whether they're in Canada, is what's your definition of success in farming?
So we got a legacy statement that kind of states we want to leave the land, the financial statements, and the industry in a better state generation after generation. So, you know, I think that fits the bill pretty good. We want to take care of the land and improve it. We want to make sure the financial statements are better generation after generation, but there also needs to be an industry and a community and a great team for the farm to keep going and for the industry to succeed. So that's probably the phrase I'd use.
No, that's a good phrase. So again, Christian, thank you very much. Probably I have a feeling I might be giving you another call in 6 months or a year just to do a follow-up and see what has maybe changed. And hopefully I can get across the border and come visit you this year. So now the border, is it still pretty much you can't get into Canada or into the U.S. right now? Is that true?
Well, we can cross. My dad's actually going this week to get some parts from across the border. So I think you can cross for like essential type services. So we need some farm parts. He's going to be able to get across. But I think for non-essential travel, it's still, I'm not saying it's not doable, but I think it's a pain in the ass.
I think you're right about that. So but again, Christian, thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Paul Niefer, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of the Farm CPA podcast with Top Producer.